Sunrose Yoga. Reveal and remember your sacred nature through the practice of yoga. The Sunrose Yoga Podcast is a collection of audio recordings, videos, and writings about the practices of yoga. The podcast's mission is to share the teachings of yoga in an accessible way and to foster meaningful discussion about the practices. To learn more or to experience past teachings, please visit sunroseyoga.com. The Sunrose Yoga Podcast is made possible by the generous donations of students and supporters. If you find this podcast useful or beneficial, please consider making a secure online donation by clicking the donate button at sunroseyoga.com. And thanks. Hello, my beloveds, and welcome to episode 110 of the Sunrose Yoga Podcast. I am Kelly Connor Sunrose, and you don't want to talk?
I do.
Okay, say, I'm Una Cassini Sunrose.
I'm Una Cassini Sunrose, and I love to watch Frozen, and I love to watch Sleeping Beauty.
In this episode, I share a deep conversation with Saraswati Hewitt. Saraswati is a force of nature. She flows like a river. She is a mother, a yogini, a student of neuroscience, and an absolute advocate for yoga's life-changing potential. Thank you all so much for being here today to listen to this conversation. You can learn more about Saraswati in the show notes or by visiting her website, saraswatihewitt.com. Love. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
How about, would you like to just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about where you practice and teach yoga?
Yeah. So my name is Saraswati Hewitt, and I've been a teacher for over 10 years now. And currently I teach at Yoga Refuge PDX, and I sub at The Pearl and at Chantillon. But I used to be a co-owner of a busy studio here, and because it was incredibly stressful and I really found that I didn't love running the studio, I chose to let that go. And through finding out about kind of stress and its effects, I then got into the neuroscience. So starting in about a month, I'm going to be attending PSU, Portland State, to study interpersonal neurobiology and the neuroscience of yoga and meditation.
How did you get into that?
It's kind of funny, actually, because I actually studied anatomy. I started at like 16 because I was at a really great school. I grew up in Alaska in this small town called Ketchikan. There's some really phenomenal programs, though, and they did this whole like medical, like a college level medical course in the high school. And so I actually started studying anatomy about 16. And actually, it's kind of funny because I initially wanted to study the brain. But I think because my brain wasn't developed, like, right, that prefrontal cortex wasn't developed yet, I couldn't really do it. It just seemed too big for me. And so I kind of left that alone and did other stuff. And then I came to yoga at like 19, 20 and kind of went back into the anatomy. But what was funny is even after teaching for all those years, running the studio that I co-owned was so stressful that the day that I signed the papers and kind of like let that go, I finally had time to myself for the first time in 13 months. So totally random. I sat down and I was like, oh my God, I have 5 seconds. So I ended up watching a documentary that was Dr. Sapolsky, who's the neuroendocrinologist at Stanford, and he had uncoded stress by studying baboons in Kenya for 30 years. And when I watched it, I basically fucking freaked out because I was like, yoga cures this. Mm-hmm. Yoga cures, like, it was like all these questions, like, all okay, this is what stress is, this is what happens, like, and when I saw that and realized I'm like sitting on a key, I felt like I was like hiding, like my butt was like hiding the key from the world, and I was like, oh wow, dude, does anybody know this? Mm-hmm. So I went right to my computer and I typed in neuroscience yoga, and this course at Kripalu came up with Dr. Jim Hopper and Dana Moore, and I immediately signed up for it. So in June, I went back and studied with kind of the head. The real head is Bessel van der Kolk, but Bessel trained Dana, and Dana and Jim trained me on like neuroscience, modern yoga, mindfulness, and trauma, and kind of how we can help people to change their brains. Because that's what we realize, is that no matter, you know, what's been done, essentially, we can change that. And yoga and meditation, like, we all know as practitioners, like, this really changes people, this is going to change the world, but now we can use the MRIs, the magnetic resonance machines, like, we can see this is real, this is for real, yeah.
Absolutely.
So now that's kind of my jam, is learning more about kind of the effects of yoga and meditation. It's a little easier to study the meditation, because it's like meditation, but yoga can be so many, you know, different things as far as the physical, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I've gotten into the brain study aspect.
Oh, that's beautiful. And so does PSU, like, are you going to be working on some sort of degree, or is it sort of an a la carte type course of study that you're designing yourself, or do they have...
Well, actually, it's a real specific course, but it's not a degree. That's the thing that's interesting. It's like a graduate program, so you get a certificate. And it's a very funny thing, the way that the universe works, because my good friend Janie Dial, who is also a yoga teacher, and I had talked to her about my interest in the study, and she said, oh, have you heard about this course at PSU? And she's the one who actually told me about it, because she said, you know, Sarah Joy, who's a very famous teacher, who has the Daya Foundation, this is the course that she took. Mm. So that's what kind of ignited this for her, and she works with a lot of incredible people, you know, dealing with different levels of trauma and addiction. And I looked into it, and I was like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's all based off of Dan Siegel's kind of work, and yeah. And it's funny, because the universe just really, like, pulled me into this super specific path, and I just didn't resist, and by not resisting, I keep ending up in the right places and just meeting these phenomenal people, and it's pretty mind-blowing, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard to do that. Like, that takes... Yes. That's the work.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you have any idea? I mean, this is almost like the counterpoint to what we've been talking about, but... Like, do you have any idea of where it could lead? Or do you see...
Totally.
Yeah, like, in your dreams, where would it go?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you asked that, because once I started studying, because, you know, I was so stressed and depressed and just, like, wrecked and burned out my adrenals, was just had destroyed myself almost, you know, to run this studio, and I have two young children, so just like a lot of the driving back and forth really was, it really burned me out. So because of that, and I had kind of a interesting life, right, all through life, let's put it that, that's a nice word, interesting life. So once I started studying all of the neuroscience, then that, you know, kind of, I ended up just learning about all these different things, so then learning about the effects, you know, depression and trauma. So as I started delving into this, I started to uncode things within myself. So this is interesting that I'm, you know, doing this for an interview, because I'm essentially at this moment choosing to tell the world that I discovered that not only am I bipolar, and that I had been using yoga and meditation to, I think, cure myself, but it's really ongoing. It's like a practice, truly, mm-hmm. to continue to heal myself. But I found out that I had also been born with a personality disorder called borderline. And I had no idea until I started researching all this. But then the really incredible thing came when I went to Kripalu and started talking with, you know, some of the world's best psychologists and realizing, well, here's the amazing thing. There's no mistake that I've come to all of this because I know and am working on proving that borderline, which we thought was probably incurable, is absolutely curable, and it's curable with yoga and meditation. So I'm going to be working with the heads of that world, and hopefully eventually do MRI scanning work and begin to prove that. And this is, it's very important for everyone to have yoga and meditation, but this specific population, there's a real high suicide rate. And so that, it's interesting too. Part of the reason I'm really excited to be open about this is like with the current loss of Robin Williams and all of a sudden people realizing, oh, okay, bipolar depression, like this is very real. We maybe need to be taking this more seriously. I feel like, okay, it's time. It's time to be like, okay, so these are the things that are going on, you know, in my personal experience, and that's, you know, that's okay, because everyone we're seeing has these experiences, but the more we kind of shut that down, I think it becomes really dangerous. So I'm just like, let's just go there, right? Because the best thing that we can do is to help each other and to have as many tools possible. And I keep thinking, you know, on so many terms for so many people, how different their lives would be, how different their lives could have been if they had yoga and meditation. Mm-hmm. So my work is going to be kind of proving, because if we could work with the Western medicine more, then getting more yoga and meditation to people as really like a yoga, like a therapy, really truly like as therapy. Mm-hmm. But just having it more available to everyone as prevention, because then I think in general we would see less depression, you know. I was talking with the yoga students this week. I was kind of breaking down the word vipassana. And, you know, vipassana, which is, you know, it's like 3 to 10 days where you do these big meditation sits, but vipassana being to see things as they really are. And for specifically, like, people who are bipolar and borderline, they do this kind of type of therapy, this DBT, which essentially is seeing things as they really are. It's like these parts of the brain that some of us didn't really develop. It's like you have to create that. You have to create this filter, mm-hmm. and you have to do the work to see things as they are. And there's so many levels to that, you know. But
well, and even if you're not, you know, even if there's not a diagnosis, I mean, every single person does that. Like,
yes.
You know, I mean, that's the work. It's
exactly.
Like yoga is seeing more clearly what is actually happening and
yes.
feeling what's happening rather than feeling something like your elbow for a minute and then being drawn into that reliable old story that you always tell yourself about why
yes.
your elbow is the way it is and, oh, if only, you know, this had happened.
Totally.
And it's, I mean, it's just so liberating for everyone.
Yeah.
And it's tricky because it's like, you know, you ride that edge of, you know, some, if you're not ready to hear that, like hearing yoga is, or, you know, whatever, meditation is experiencing more clearly what's actually happening. Like, it sounds so, like, ridiculously simple. Like, that is the work of a lifetime.
I know, that's the funny thing is that, right, we've all the technology in the world, right? It's just phenomenal. We have the most advanced computer in the world is our brain. And yet, really, what cures everything is just sitting around and breathing. Like, it sounds almost ridiculous. And it's just, that's the truth, right? I mean, Sarah Lazar, who's, she was a neuroscientist and then had like a injury because she was, I think, training for a marathon. She started doing yoga. And she mentions in this interview how she was like, I got really annoyed at first because they're like, oh, you're going to be more compassionate, you're going to be all this. And she just thought that was just so dumb. But then after a while, she was like, well, what the hell? I feel better. I feel more compassionate. And so she's the one who was like, let's look at the brain. Let's see what's going on. Because mm-hmm. she realized this is real. And it is, because we thought, you know, back in the day, oh, you got your brain and that's what you get. Good luck with that, camper, right? Mm-hmm. No, it changes. This is neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. And you feel that when you do yoga. And not just in the physical. It's like you do things maybe you physically never imagined, but then it's like it turns something on in the brain because you're like, oh, wow, I just did something I had no idea I could do. And that's just this like tiny slice, but you start to... it starts to leach out into everything that you do and every interaction that you have. And to somebody, I mean, that's important for all of us, every single person, but to somebody who's horribly depressed or on the verge of like taking their own life or something, like that's the medicine. Like mm-hmm. that needs to be available to people to be able to see that there are all these options, that things, to be able to know that things can change. Like, no, that's not just you. You know, you might be different tomorrow. Maybe you're different than you were yesterday. So
yeah.
How can we support positive changes for everybody?
That's exciting.
It is. It's really exciting.
Tell me more about your interesting life. So you're you're a mama.
I am. I'm a mom. Part of my interesting life comes that I have two children. So my daughter is like 3.5 and my son is 6.5 and our son is on the autism spectrum. So that's a whole amazing realm. He's about, you know, mid-functioning. He's incredible. He's an incredible person. My kids are both, they're so funny. They're so awesome. But yeah, dealing with autism is very interesting, being a yoga teacher. And both of my pregnancies were very unusual. I had hyperemesis gravidarum, which is a non-stop vomiting. So I was in bed for most of 20 months.
Oh.
So that's interesting too, because, you know, one of the things I say to my students, is, you know, whatever you did yesterday might be different than today. And I say that because, you know, you might go from this incredibly advanced physically vinyasa practice and then one day you can't get out of bed. Mm-hmm. And what's not going to matter is how good your handstand was at that point. What's going to matter is how you can breathe and how you can deal with the truly like the fluctuations of the mind. So that's why, I mean, we say that a lot in yoga, but I'm like, no, seriously, guys, like, you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. You might not have that leg tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or that part of your head. Like, you have no idea what's going to happen. So you get really good at the breathing and the staying present. Because I couldn't do physical yoga for 20 months. So that was really interesting. And then to have our first kid be born with autism after that. So it's been a very interesting journey. Yeah. I think I've kind of been handed a lot of things in this life, but I in no way think of it as negative. I feel like it's sort of like this gift, like I was supposed to just deal and work with all these things so that I could help other people. Like, very seriously, I feel like that's kind of why I'm here, is to just help as many people as possible. Mm. So I just kept seeing interesting things. And, yeah.
Mm. So you mentioned that you're from Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Were you in, how long have you been in Portland?
I've actually only been in Portland for about 3 years. I spent like about 23 years, in Alaska, and then I've lived in some different places, little stints in Hawaii and, New York and a little bit in Seattle, but yeah, we've lived here for like 3 years.
So did you have your babies in Seattle?
Actually, Tyler was born, in California. No, Tyler was born in Santa Rosa when we lived in Sebastopol, and Mazzy was actually born here.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. So we've been here for a while. We did some traveling. I kind of think I knew that I wanted to have kids, and so I did a little bit of traveling early. My yoga school was, part of it was actually in Seattle, and then part of it was in Bali. I lived for a few months in Bali about 10 years ago and did a lot of my training there. But I also went through India when I was like 24, I think. No, I must have been 23 because I got pregnant at 25. Yeah, I think about 23. I backpacked alone through India for about 4 months and just kind of checked out different parts of India. Mm. Yeah. Mm. But we've been here for about 3 years and it's awesome. This place blows my mind. It's like, you know, yoga heaven. There's so much amazing yoga going on here. It's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about like the evolution of your practice, how you started and then, you know, wound up in Bali and how that all came together.
Well, I grew up as a dancer and I played lots of sports, so there's a lot of physical movement that just came really naturally. And actually that's why my friend Heather Walker actually was the one who, I think we must have been like 19, and she says to me about yoga and I was like, what's yoga? And she just gave me, she was like, what? She was like, how do you not know what yoga is? And because she's like, didn't you grow up as a dancer? And I was like, yeah, I never heard of it. So, so funny. I took, my very first class was from Yvonne Zerbitz, she's an incredible teacher, but she's also this amazing artist. And it's kind of funny that I ended up taking my first class from her, because the first studio I ever taught at ended up being her studio. But I took one class from her. And then it's really funny how life works. So I moved to Seattle, and literally a block from my house, like not even a block, like I could probably like throw a stone, was this giant old church and this yoga studio called the Hatha Yoga Center. And when I walked in, and keeping in mind that my teachers weren't even there, they were actually on a training in Bali at that time. The moment I walked in there, it was like coming home. Mm-hmm. And the moment I set foot in that place, I was like, whatever's happening here, I'm gonna do it. So I took my first class, and then about a week later, my teachers, Bob Smith and Kim McGraw, returned from training in Bali, and I started going like up to their classes, and I went to at least one class a day, sometimes two a day, sometimes more, and I did that constantly for about a year. It was about a year, maybe it was a year and a half. And then what happened, so at the time, I actually wanted to become, my mother was a librarian, so I read a lot, and I was really interested in literature, because at that time, you know, I was always thinking about how can I help the most people possible, and at that time, I felt like, okay, so writing, or, you know, somehow getting information out into the world, and I was actually interested in studying specifically Russian literature. That was kind of what I wanted to do, was to specialize in that. But my gurus kept being like, you know, we really think you should teach yoga. And I was like, no, I don't want to teach yoga. And they're like, yeah, we really think you should teach yoga. And they liked that I didn't want to teach yoga because they felt that was a good start. So after a while, I was like, okay, maybe I'll teach yoga. And everything just sort of fell into place, and I found myself in Bali, and I loved it, and I worked very hard, and I became a 200-hour trainer from that space. And I really, like, funny, because when I came home back to the States, I went right back to my hometown, and then Yvonne, who had taught me my first class, her and these other cool women owned a studio, like a co-op, so I immediately began teaching. Like, 2 days after I was trained, I was teaching classes, and that's kind of how it started. I was trained with a really classical Hatha Iyengar influence, and then it's really evolved. Different people have influenced it. One of the people that really influenced my teaching the last couple of years is a teacher named Sweet Home Tika, because she brought in she's talked about a lot of things. Like, while we were practicing, she was, like, asking questions and talking about really big things. And a lot of teachers that I had seen prior to that, it was just really kind of basic, and it wasn't really until people went to trainings or workshops that they really opened up into this, but Sweden was just, like, going for it every class, and I realized that that's what part of what I wanted to do in my style was to bring something different into it, and so starting to talk just a little bit, little pieces here, you know, about the, you know, whether it's the chakra system or what different words mean, or just kind of going deeper, and then I feel like my teaching really has changed in the last few months, because now that I, you know, understand more of the neuroscience, I talk about that, and talking about, you know, your brain is, you know, producing a thought like every half second, and we're constantly working to figure things out. But really, you know, what happens in, like, the monk of a brain when they're meditating is they're just watching that. They become, like, truly an observer to the mind. And when we practice yoga, and if a teacher is, like, kind of asking us questions or really asking us to be real with ourselves, then it starts to produce this kind of therapy. Like, it really becomes therapy, because you start to see yourself and see, you know, how are you physically dealing with things? So then how are you emotionally dealing with things? And it's just sort of this process that I started to pull, you know, onto the mat, and really, like, almost turning it, like, into a kind of therapy. But we're doing the work on our own. And as much as we are willing to bring, you know, that's what we get out of it every single time. We just have to show up, and then it seems to work. Mm-hmm. And I teach lots of different styles now. I teach a little bit of yin, and I still love to teach intro, and but it's just kind of different all the time, and I don't go in with a plan, really. I just sort of go in, and I look at who's in the class, and then I watch for about the first 5 minutes, and I'm really watching what everyone is doing, and then I sort of create this median of, like, how can we give everyone what they're going to need. It's not always what they want, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. How do you... 2-part question. How do you, as a mom and a teacher, make space for your own practice? And what does your personal practice look like?
My personal practice is so different all the time. My kids are pretty wild, so I can't really practice in my home, otherwise I become the jungle gym. And if I go to hide in another room, it's like they know I'm doing something without them. So it's pretty hard to practice in my home. Last night I was practicing, but I was doing it late, like once they've gone to bed. So sometimes it's like that. Sometimes I wake up real early and I meditate and I practice. But a lot of times I go to different teachers because I really enjoy it. And I go to lots of different classes. And part of that work, too, I do for the magazine that I work for, because I'm just kind of looking, you know, all the time for different things going on. But I really kind of love that, because yoga seems to be this thing that's like, it's like it's alive, you know, and it's changing all the time. And so sometimes, like, I'll go to a, you know, some super sweaty, like, power vinyasa class, and sometimes I'll just go take a real, like, a hatha class or a yin, or I just kind of go all over. And the truth of my personal practice is there are some things physically that I don't do a lot of. Like, for example, my back's pretty flexible, so, like, in my own practice, I don't do a ton of back bending. But I do a lot of, like, TFL and so on. I do a lot of inner hip stretching because that's what my body needs. And I really just do, I kind of stretch throughout the day because I know the reality of doing an hour and 15 minutes in my home with two kids and a kid on the spectrum who thinks sleep is silly, right? It's challenging. And a lot of the work, you know, for me is finding the quiet and the work in the mind, which makes more sense, you know, now than ever, because I understand And we teach this and we know this, that, you know, all the physical postures were really, they're just there so that we can sit and meditate. But I feel the reality of that, because where I feel a lot of the work done for myself is when I can meditate and when I can just like sit quietly and just kind of see the working of the mind. But yeah, for physical practice, it's so different. Like sometimes I'll go take Ashtanga over at Near East with Casey Palmer. He's really great. But I really just vary it, and I just sort of listen to my body. So I might end up doing really specific things for like a block, and then maybe I don't touch those postures for a while. And, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to encourage the students to practice like that too. As we kind of go through classes, I'm always like, notice the ones that maybe you like, and then notice the ones maybe you don't like, right? And kind of think about if you were just going to like 5 or 10 minutes, what would you do? And so that's how I practice, is I just really pull in what are the things that I can do that probably need the most work, because it might be 5 minutes, like doing mm-hmm. lunges in the kitchen, mm-hmm. cooking some spaghetti, doing some lunges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to, for me, I have to get up at 5 a.m. I get up, and in the summer it's been nice because I go outside and sit. Awesome. And if I do not, I have to sit. Here, I like my asana practice, like, you know, ebbs and flows, but I have to sit.
Yeah.
And that's when it gets done. Otherwise, like, once the day, you know how it is. Like, once the day gets rolling, I mean, you can't push pause on your young people. And, like, that's the work, is, like, being with them completely.
Yeah.
Like, totally. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the most rewarding and the hardest practice I have found, is being present with my kids. Mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about this a lot recently, because I've actually had a lot of death kind of in my circle, lots of people passing, losing partners, and it's funny because I wrote this thing last week and I was kind of talking about how sometimes it's the hardest thing that we can do to really just be present in every moment, and that the gift of experiencing death and loss is it really reminds us and nails home that we have no idea what's going to happen from one moment to the next, and that things that are just, you know, simple and everyday are really profound. And when you have kids, it's like these chia pets that don't stop growing, and you just watch this life in front of you. But with that, you know, with birth obviously comes, you know, death, and so all this time in between, I really think just being with it and just being able to cherish whatever we get served is really what it's all about. But I mean, that's hard. That's really hard sometimes, right? You know, like mm-hmm. when my kids are like driving me nuts, that's what I make myself remember. I'm like, you know, imagine if something tragic were to happen, you would pay $1 million to have the worst day back.
Mm-hmm. Mm, absolutely. And it's interesting because, like, with so many other things in our lives, there's an out. Like, you can check out so easily.
Yeah.
Like, even, you know, with your beloved, like, you don't want to, but you can check out. And most of us don't want to do that. But it's like the pattern is there and the habit is there, and rewriting that code takes time. But kids are like presence, and it's amazing. And like, there are those moments where you're just like, oh my God, I'm pulling my hair out.
Yeah.
and that's part of it. Like, we get so many chances to start over.
Yep.
And I don't know about you, but like, but for me, like, oh my gosh, if I have that spark of realization, or that, like, I am totally acting like a jerk right now, like, and then you want to beat yourself up about it, But you're, yeah. But like that takes you out of the moment too. So you just have to like start over again and over again.
Yeah, and that's part of like the whole forgiveness. And they, you know, you hear that a lot. Like, oh, it starts with yourself. But that's the reality, right? We can't even dwell on the things that we've done wrong because then again we're out of the present. So all we can do is just be like goldfish, right? Mm-hmm. Just circling back.
Yeah, oh, I love that. So tell me about this, the magazine. You work for Mantra.
Yeah, I'm the Oregon editor for Mantra Yoga and Health magazine, and it's amazing. My editor, Miranda Pleasant, is just, she's so phenomenal. She's a really incredible person. Just really working to show all the amazing things that yoga is really doing, and a lot of it's not mainstream at all. She's bringing a lot of things mainstream. And one of my goals, and part of why I'm so happy to be a part of it, is because what I do is I spotlight people. So I'll come up with a question, and then the people answer that question. They send back with a photo and, like, you know, all their information. And like the last time, one of the questions that I asked was like, what kind of yoga do you teach? And so I asked two people that I know that work with trauma. And so this woman, Liz, she works like with a lot of people who are traffic survivors and just pretty major stuff. She works on four continents, so, you know, she's seeing a lot of different stuff. And, you know, talked about what she's doing, the kind of work she does, and like Dana Moore and his work with mind-body centering. And then, you know, talking about people who do, you know, yoga like mom and baby, or yoga for the deaf, or like, It's just giving us an opportunity to do more than talk about, you know, five ways to make your abs look better. And it's just talking about all of the dimensions of yoga and what you know, what we're choosing to do with it. And I'm actually really excited because in the upcoming issue, one of the questions that I asked people was, what brought you to yoga, and then why did you stay? Because a lot of us came for one reason and stayed for a very different reason. And I think that's like the kind of thing that, especially if someone's never, I mean, whether we've been doing yoga for years and we read the magazine or never done in your life, I want people to get this really broad view of like, look at all these different people doing yoga and look how they came to this and look how it's changing their lives, because it does change our lives. And I really want people to find this practice, because the thing about yoga and meditation, you know, we have these cute mats and these little straps and all this fun stuff, but the reality is all you need for yoga is you. Mm-hmm. And that's profound. It's also dangerous in some ways to people, because you can't really sell it. Not really.
Mm-hmm. It's countercultural. It's radical.
It is radical, because it's saying, basically, you can get all these tools from different, you know, people, but it's really going to be your own. It's going to come down to, like, you have to create your yoga. Mm-hmm. And all you need is you. That's like, phenomenal. And I think that we're just so bombarded, you know, with media and so many things telling us what we're supposed to look like and where, and on so many levels, you know, how we're supposed to be doing this and this. But with yoga, after a while, you know, you just realize that it's what you're going to make it. That my yoga is my yoga and yours is yours, and everyone else creates what works for them. And don't even be attached to that, because that's going to change. Mm-hmm. And you just keep creating what works. But it does work. That's the thing that just blows me away, is I see every day. I mean, I see every day. I have these so interesting stories, you know, people who I saw them take like their first yoga class, and now, you know, they're these great teachers. And it's just like, just to see this evolution, even people who maybe they don't teach, maybe you've just seen how it affects their lives and the choices that they've made in these, you know, in this time as they practice yoga. And it just brings us back to our core, our heart, and, you know, really who we're supposed to be and what we're supposed to be doing. Because you can't hide from yourself in yoga. Mm-hmm. You can't. I mean, you can try, but it just, you just keep finding yourself, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think there's something really powerful about having those conversations. And this is one of the things that I really like about what Miranda does with her magazines, like Origin and Mantra, is the conversations.
Yeah.
And I think they're important. And I think just asking questions and getting people to get to become clear about, or maybe like the clarity comes 10 years later, but just like planting that seed of a question is really important. Super awesome. I'm so psyched that you're involved with that and asking and meeting and talking and
it's incredible.
Yoking.
it's such a privilege and an honor, and I really I want to do, you know, the best possible things, and Miranda inspires all of that, because it's like, how do we really put out there what's happening and the things that people are doing? How are people, you know, using this in their everyday lives, and then how are people using this, to change the world? Like, there's a lot of people. Like, there was some really great article in the last one. They're talking about people who are raising money in New Jersey. But there's yoga's, you know, part of what happens, I think, is the more you practice, right? Maybe it starts where we come for physical reasons, or, you know, we're trying to heal injury. But we all find our way to, okay, so we start to work out our own stuff. Then comes this aspect of seva and of service. So then how do we use this, you know, to not only help ourselves, but to start to shift the world? And I just have met the most phenomenal people who are like doing these incredible things. Like, I know this woman, Bhakti Foster, she works with a women's co-op in India. And they make yoga bags. And then all the money, like all the proceeds, go to this special needs orphanage. And it's like, that's what a great idea. Like, what a great thing to do. So it's like you're creating this circle. Everyone's getting what they need. And it's, you know, I see it going out, you know, into looking at the things we eat. Like, there's a lot of awesome articles in both Origin and Mantra about, like, eco-clothing. And I'm actually going to talk about that in the next... probably in the Christmas issue, I'm going to do something on that. But just realizing that, like, the things that we do and say, they matter. And, like, the world seems really big, so we think, oh, I won't have that big an impact. But it's the complete opposite, that as big as the world is, the things that we say and do have enormous impact. And when we practice yoga and we start to, like, see how powerful our mind is, then you start to realize, like, oh, wow, like, the way I shop or the way that I talk to people or the way I do everything, like, it actually matters, because it's like this domino effect in the world, and it's very real. So, yeah, my hope is that we'll just continue to help more people and bring more people into realizing that yoga and meditation is really for everyone. It's just going to look different for everyone, mm-hmm. but it really needs to be available to everybody.
Yeah, so now you have, on top of all this other wonderful work that you're doing, you're going to Alaska, and you have, is it called the Southeast Alaska Yoga Project?
That's what it's called currently. It may end up hopefully becoming Alaska Yoga Project, because hopefully we'll just, like, keep expanding it. But I grew up, you know, in Ketchikan, Alaska, and my really good friend Chris Myers, who is also a great yoga teacher, she was born in Juneau, and she's actually Haida Tlingit. So we were talking one day. We were talking about just how do we give people yoga who, I mean, everyone needs yoga, everyone deserves yoga, but maybe people who are not going to be as likely to hear about it or to get that experience. And we were like, well, man, if we really wanted to do something cool, we'd go back to Alaska. And then we both just kind of looked at each other and were like, well, then I guess then we need to do that. And the classes that I'm going to teach, I'm actually going to be up there September 8th through, like, about the 20th. And for this round, I'm going to be just teaching. Chris won't be on this particular one. We're going to be doing some projects throughout the next year where we're both going to be teaching on site. But for this one, I'm going to go up to Ketchikan and over to Metlakatla. Metlakatla is the, I believe it's the only reservation in Alaska. It's incredible, really incredible communities that have opened the doors for me to come in and do this. And I'm going to be teaching a couple classes a day in each place, and everything is open to the community, but we really are hoping that we'll see more of the Native community, or no, that doesn't sound right, that we'll be seeing people from the Native community, because there's such a boom of interest in Native art right now, and I think that this is a really good time, you know, to talk about, you know, whether it's, you know, India and being interested in, you know, Sanskrit, or I think whatever it is, all these ancient cultures have a lot to teach, and so I think it's really important that, you know, when we like the art or when we like the stories from things, that we go back to remembering the real history of these cultures and these people and traditions, and looking at the people who actually are responsible for carrying, you know, symbolism and story, carrying this through generations, especially at times when it was not easy and it was not looked at as cool. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a huge piece of why we really wanted to do it, was just to bring to light that there are so many ancient cultures, and that we need to preserve them, because when we lose, you know, especially elders in these communities, it's like we're losing a library, essentially, of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so doing the most to preserve the mental, physical, spiritual health of these people. And really of all people, because part of what we're doing in Alaska is we're kind of keeping our eyes open for people in these communities that seem like they might become teachers. And then the next part of our project will be to raise money to put people through yoga training that maybe couldn't afford it otherwise. And then they can bring that back into the community and have a job and have a way to keep this in their community.
Mm, beautiful.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And actually, I'm leaving yoga mats. So Street Yoga and Living Yoga, which are both incredible, wonderful organizations, they both donated mats. So I'm bringing, like, I think I have like 50, 70 yoga mats that I'm bringing that I'm just going to be like leaving in the community, so people will have those to practice, continue to practice.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Mm.
Yeah.
Tell me about your name.
So I was not born with the name Saraswati. This is actually a fun one. So I was born as Brittany Hewitt, which is fun.
Brittany.
Yeah, which is kind of fun. I know, yeah. And I had no idea that I would change my name.
Yeah.
And when I was actually, I had just decided that I was going to be going to yoga school. And I guess that, yeah, so it was about 10 years ago. And my gurus had already gone to Bali. And I was actually in a meditation in Seattle at the studio. My teacher's already in Bali, and I was meditating, and I had a very profound experience where who I now know as Babaji, but at the time I didn't know who had come to me. Babaji basically came to me and was like, hey, you're going to change your name, you're going to see a word, and it's going to be on fire, and you're going to change your name. And I remember actually coming out of my meditation laughing, because I was like, that's stupid. I'm not going to change my name. And then I just thought that was, like, so funny. And then, like, about 2 days later, I was reading, I was actually reading a Feuerstein book about Tantra, which is random, because I don't really practice Tantra, but I read all kinds of mm-hmm. stuff. And I remember turning the page, and the word Saraswati was, like, on fire, and it was bright red. And I saved the book, and the word is not red. But in that moment, the word was bright red. And I dropped the book, and I just had chills. And it was the weirdest thing, because the moment I saw it, I became Saraswati. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, in a second, it was just like my old name was gone. This was done. And it has felt completely perfect ever since. I've never mistaken or messed that. It was like, and then now we're in this realm. Mm. I brought the word to my gurus who were in Indonesia, and I said, hey, this name has come to me, you know, and they kind of laughed and they were like, do you know what it is? I was like, yeah, it's a river. It means she who flows. And they were like, oh, it's a lot more than a river. Mm-hmm. They were like, this is a goddess, you know, in India and in the Hindu culture and religion. And what was funny was the next week I was, you know, I'm in Bali when I bring them this name, and they said, well, it's going to be Saraswati Day. So I was brought to a tailor and put in this beautiful lace Balinese gown, and on the day that it was Saraswati Day, everything is basically shut down, and they put books in the street because she's the goddess of knowledge as well as many other things, music, and so they bring out all the books to bless the books. And on that day, very interesting because, you know, the translation is she who flows, there was this giant, like, crazy rain that just, like, wiped out Bali. Mm-hmm. So I remember, like, running through, you know, like, ankle, like, calf-deep water to go to this temple to be initiated on Saraswati Day and taking this name. So it was really, like, the most phenomenal, it was really just the strangest, most phenomenal thing, but it was just meant to be. Like, it wasn't even, like, you know, in the moment of meditation, hearing that I would change my name, that sounded so funny, and then it's just been, that's just who I was, who I became.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bali sounds pretty magical.
Oh, Bali's so phenomenal. Bali is, you know, because it's this Hindu culture, and actually most of Indonesia is a Muslim culture, so it's really like, it's like this magical place, and there's so much to it because it's like all of their concept with the spiritual and of God, and then there's just so much art and music, and Bali's just big. Like, it's, you know, everything about it is just really, yeah, it's magical. Like, there's something magical about it. Interesting, very interesting, actually. So, part of my crazy life, right? I'm always in an interesting place at a certain time. So that was actually the second time I've been in Bali when I went to yoga school, because I happened to be there years before that when the bombings happened. I was in Bali when that happened. And I'm very lucky to be alive because the clubs that got bombed, I was at those clubs the night before.
Wow.
But because I'm very lucky, I was not there.
Yeah.
So, interesting. A lot of us have sort of karma with Bali. Very truly, like, it's a really intense, magical place. But, so it was an interesting thing to find out that my teachers held their trainings there. Mm. So when I went back to become a teacher, that was very healing to return to this place that I had been there when there was, you know, the worst thing that had happened in hundreds of years there.
Yeah.
So that's interesting that I have a deep connection with Bali. Yeah.
I'm going there in
a
month.
Oh.
I've never been. Well, my whole family is going with me.
It's phenomenal. I mean, it's like, everything about it, it's phenomenal. It's so beautiful, and the smells and the food, and it's just miraculous. It really is. You'll have an amazing time.
Mm-hmm.
It's got like such a different, like, you know, after being in India, because India can be really intense, there's just like such a sweetness to Bali because it's a different, you know, kind of spin. Like, it's not like the same as the Hinduism in India. But everything, I mean, you know, you'll see that every morning there's all these beautiful offerings being made with banana leaves and the flowers, and there's so much ritual and tradition that's just like so alive in Bali. And like, you know, you'll go to one town and that whole town just does like silver making. Mm-hmm. And then the next town like just does wood carving or stone. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's so incredible to see just how the spiritual, it's, you know, it's not like something that like it's 2 hours on Sunday morning style. It's like in every single aspect of everything going on. Like, they won't go, the Balinese won't go in the water, and like they think it's funny that we swim and stuff on the beaches, because they have a legend around the Witch King. I can't remember the Witch King's name, but like, so they, you know, they won't swim in the water because of their legends. And it's just so phenomenal. Everything is like, everything that happens to people when they're in Bali, it's like, even if we don't realize it till after, it's like it's all got so much meaning. It's like Bali is just a really, really special place. And it's just embodying beauty and being in the moment constantly. And they really live this way. Like, there's a book where they're talking about how, you know, we have everything in America, except so many people go to Bali because there's something that they don't have, and we're searching, and it's like whatever it is that you need or you need to see, you'll find it in Bali, and it might not always come like you think it's gonna come, right? You might get bit by a monkey, or, you know, something, but yeah, but Bali shows us very important thing. She's a very interesting mirror.
I'm so glad we did this.
I'm really glad too. This is really fun because, yeah, I get to have, you know, little mini conversations with people about different things, but yeah, it's good. I think it's important to talk about all these different aspects of what it is that we're doing with our time here.
And it's interesting, I found like so much of my learning and my evolution through the practice has come just by listening to other people process and eat in those moments, you know, where they might just be thinking like, oh, I don't know where I am, I'm just talking. But it's so significant and meaningful and helpful to people. Like, to just hear, like, we're all in this together.
Yes.
And we're all making our way. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. It was really awesome.